Entrepreneur of square dancing, and we'll learn more about that as time goes along. So, Bill, tell me, well, I would say where you're born and brought up, and a little bit about life before square dancing.
Sure. Thanks very much, Bob. I'm certainly pleased to be interviewed. Born in 1940, middle-class family, Jersey City, New Jersey, second generation American, and very, very lucky to have wonderful parents who lived a long, long time. My mother, in fact, is still alive. I was raised, as I said, in Jersey City, New Jersey, and relatively shortly thereafter, as everybody knows, the war broke out, and my dad, along with millions of others, volunteered to go into the Army, and that began what turned out to be basically a six-year saga for everybody. And during the wartime years, we lived first in Jersey City, then we lived in Dothan, Alabama, following my dad, then went to Petersburg, Virginia for a brief period of time. Then Dad headed to parts unknown because he wasn't allowed to tell us where he went. Turned out he went to Washington State and then on to Hawaii, and he became a training officer on Hawaii and actually spent, interestingly enough, most of the war in Hawaii, and was, as with many hundreds of thousands of others in the invasionary force, going into Japan. And he returned to us in 1946, and at that time we moved to Bloomfield, New Jersey, very small residential town outside of Newark, New Jersey. And during the earliest years, when Dad was away, the way my mother supported us was, among other things, she was a waterfront counselor up at a camp. The reason I mention it is it was at that camp that I first became familiar with square dancing.
Okay.
When I was three, 4, and 5 years old, I was at a camp that had a relatively heavy square and folk dancing content at that time. And it becomes germane because in 1952, I was 12 years old. That was the summer camp I chose to go back to. And I spent the whole summer at the age of 12 square dancing.
There you go.
That was really I mentioned this only because that's actually how square dancing got into my blood. And I've always been a musical kind of guy, like dancing in general. And
right.
That's really my initial contact with square dancing. And to say that it changed that summer actually changed my life is an understatement.
Right. Well, how's your memory, Bill? Do you have any idea who was calling at that summer camp?
No, I was really too young.
Oh, sure.
The only title of a song that I can remember was Road to the Isles.
Is that right?
Yeah, there was one title that just stuck in my mind. I have
okay.
no reason why.
Yeah. Well, that's a round dance, of course.
Yeah, I know, but we did. Yeah. It was folk and... Spokane Square, of course, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's great. So, following that experience, then must have been searching out other places to square dance, or did that come later?
Actually, I didn't. It's sort of interesting because from that point when I was 12 until many, many years later when I was living in Europe, I really didn't square dance, not a single time. Graduated high school from Bloomfield, went to college, flunked out of college, worked in a factory,
okay.
went into the Army, etc. And I spent a year and a half in Europe and still didn't discover square dancing. That was 59. That was 59 to 61, when, of course, square dancing was really big in Europe. Didn't bump into it there, even though I was in the military. Sort of never happened. And then I came back, finished college, finished graduate school, and then a few years later ended up being sent back to Europe for Chemical Bank, a major American bank. And what happened was I was in Vienna for 5 years, Frankfurt for three, still didn't bump into square dancing. I arrive in Zurich, Switzerland. I'm general manager of the branch, and there is an American square dance club in Zurich, Switzerland.
Okay.
And that was my re-entry into the club. It was called Swiss Squares.
Yeah.
It was taught by Walt and Vicky Cooley from Walnut Creek, California, still friends of ours. And the club was basically about 50% expatriates like myself, Americans who are working overseas.
Yeah, yeah.
The rest were Swiss, Austrian, Dutch, few other nationalities mixed in there.
Right.
And I started square dancing in, I believe, early 70, the late 77. And then shortly thereafter, 6 months later, I expressed my interest in calling, and my coaching in calling started in 78.
Oh, good. Okay. And so these folks were really your sort of your mentors, and they were responsible for your basic training, so to speak.
There were. I started, we had main service. As a matter of fact, it was sort of ironic. At one point, the caller announced, "You have just finished the extended basics list." And I turned to Peggy and I said, "What's an extended basic?" Yeah. I had no idea of the structure.
Right.
I had no idea of the depth of the structure back home and all that. I was just, for a very obvious reason, just like most other square dancers in the world, there was a local club. We were looking for social interaction. Yeah. Dance was wonderful. The music was terrific. Walt and Vicky were absolutely charming and lovely.
Yeah.
And we blended right into that club. And
that's
teaching
great.
Then was actually quite slow. I ended up rotating back to the States about 9 months later. And we described ourselves as mainstream minus six. You know, we hadn't quite finished the mainstream list.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, so did you start actively calling over there and get your own club or anything like that?
Not quite. When I was in Switzerland, my job, first of all, was quite demanding. But I really didn't have the skill level to do it. And then I came back in 80, about 2 months before I rotated back to the States, so that would be maybe February, March of 79, I was invited to call for the Square Dance Club in Basel, Switzerland.
Uh-huh.
And I happened to be in the United States at the time on home leave, and I flew back early to come back and call my first Square Dance.
There you go.
it was really quite picturesque. It was on the ground floor of a barn. It was absolutely hard middle of winter. It was absolutely freezing. Everybody was square dancing in parkas, and I actually had to wear a glove on my mic hand so that my hand wouldn't stick to the microphone. Fortunately, when the dance ended, there was a nice warm living room to which we could retreat. But that was my first calling experience. Then I came back to the States in January of 80, and I think it was August of 80, I was at a local club in New Jersey, and John Colton Thaler of well known to everybody, who was the regular club caller there, and I had already known John from being in the Callers Association at that time, and he came up to me at the beginning of the dance. He said, "I'm sorry, Bill, you can't call here because this club doesn't allow guest tips by visiting callers." I said, "Not a problem. That's perfectly fine." About 4 minutes later, he came back to me. He said, "You're doing the next tip. This is your audition for the class, to teach the class." So I called other than the Basel Club, this was the first tip I had called in the United States, and it was through that tip that I ended up becoming the teacher, and in September I actually started teaching that class. That was my first mainstream class.
Oh, that's great. Well, I couldn't help but think, as you mentioned, you had to fly back to call your first dance. You became a traveling caller before you were a caller.
In a manner of speaking. Traveling caller is certainly not what I would describe myself as. I evolved in calling. I was definitely a local home club caller, regional caller to a certain extent. But I was your classic home club caller, calling a typical program.
Yeah.
And at my busiest time during that period, I probably called maybe 135 dances a year.
Uh-huh.
I was also very big on the one-nighter programs, the social clubs, churches, civic associations.
Right. Well, were there any other mentors along the way that you kind of looked up to?
But there really were. I mean, certainly my first allegiance is honestly to Walt Cooley and Vicky, his wife, because Walt really, really imbued in me a really great spirit. Every night after our regular dance class, and by the way, I taught a tip at each one of those classes on instruction, with specific assignment. He would critique it afterwards. He was very helpful and all that. I was just crazy nervous, cotton mouth. I could hardly stand. But he was very helpful, so he is really my first allegiance. Secondly, when I came back, John Kaltenthaler, who was, although he lived in Pennsylvania, northern New Jersey is really his home market.
Yeah.
John was very, very influential in setting standards. I went to my first callers college with Ralph Trout and Cal Golden in 1981 or 82. I don't remember which one it was. I was a member of Caller Lab by then. And that was a great experience. I will never forget Cal talking. He's your promotional kind of guy, sort of a preacher of square dancing, as everybody who knows and loves him.
Sure, right.
And at one point, he was talking to the whole class about motivation and you got to have good spirit and all. And after the class, I looked up and said, "Cal, The last thing I need is more motivation. I'm over-motivated already. What I need is some technical skills because I really don't quite know what I'm doing. And he certainly worked on that with me.
Yeah.
Another story, just very briefly, about Cal. We had, as is often happens at college schools, there was sort of a gathering in one of the rooms after this evening session. It was 11:30, 12 at night. And we were swapping calling stories. I was doing only listening, not swapping. And Cal got out his notebook and started flipping the pages. Hey, guys, listen to this routine. And he'd ching, 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 and he'd just go through all of these things. And I, of course, my eyes were wide open. My jaw was well dropped, hanging on the bed. And after the whole session was over, I said, boy, I'd like to come back tomorrow and take some notes because there's obviously some great material in there that would help me because I knew virtually nothing at the time. And he said, I'll do you one better. I'll lend you the book. You can take it to a photocopy shop and copy it.
There you go.
And he allowed me to copy the whole book.
Do you still have it? I do.
I do still have it.
It's got to be memorialized somewhere.
Yeah. Because the irony was that here I was, a rank beginner, with really very limited skills, and here was one of the guys who was long on the road, obviously one of the icons of square dancing, graciously sharing sort of his secret notes with the youngest kid on the block. I was very touched by that.
Great. Well, then somewhere along the line you developed your own clubs?
Yeah, what I did is that teaching assignment that I had was a grouping of three mainstream clubs with a combined class. As with all groupings of three, there were varying support levels from the three different clubs, so no surprise. And one of the...
Okay, well, tell me about any big festivals you may have attended, like local or national ones.
Sure. In my years in Jersey, there were maybe 93 teaching season.
Mm-hmm.
No, I finished 91, 92 teaching season. And at the end of 92, I knew I was moving out of New Jersey, probably to New England, and we made a decision not to accept the class for the next year because I did not want to start an academic school class year and then 3 or 5 months into it have to bail out.
Right.
I didn't. That wasn't fair.
Right.
So,
how about festivals and things like that? Do you attend any nationals or regionals or...
Yeah, but not actually as a caller. I went to our first national was Baltimore, I believe that was 84, if I'm not mistaken.
The festivals you may have attended, the nationals or any of the regional ones?
As far as local ones, we had, of course, the usual Callers Association or Dancers Association sponsored events in which I called. It's always one of multiple callers. I never had an event by myself in that area. Had the pleasure, though, of doing the Grand March at one New Jersey State Convention. So I had 120 squares. That was the largest group of people that I ever called for. It was actually quite an exciting moment in my life.
Right.
I can't tell you how pleased I was. Yeah, it was just incredible. As far as the national conventions, we started at the Nationals in 1984. Memory serves me. It was Baltimore in any event. Excuse me. And we were there at that time primarily as vendors, but I decided since I was already a caller and had a certain skill level, I could certainly call comfortable mainstream. So I signed up to do mainstream calling, and I did, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 different calls on different times, you know, usually minor time slots, you know, like 12:30 in the whatever room, you know, right in the middle of lunch hour, et cetera, which was, frankly, probably for my skill level, highly appropriate,
right.
With certainly no complaints. The problem that I ended up having, I think I then may have called the next year, I ended up stopping calling at the National Convention because my obligation was really to my booth and my customers, and I found that customers were coming to the booth to say hello to us. We were quite well known by then,
right.
And just as I was starting a nice conversation with a customer, I would have to leave because it was 30 minutes before my scheduled tip.
Right.
So I'd have to say, oh, I got to go call. And while on one hand that's very professional and the other, they certainly were pleased, I kept on walking out on conversations and realized that I wouldn't have the luxury of calling if I didn't keep my business alive. So I made a sacrifice. And we've attended every single square dance convention, national convention from 84 to the present.
Is that
without exception. And partially because we have to for the business. With the businesses, if you miss a national convention, you are out of the convention.
Right.
And during the pretty much the first 10 years of that, I was on the executive committee of the National Association of Square and Round Dance Suppliers, and eventually became its president. I was its ethics committee chairman for 4 or 5 years also.
Okay, now this I didn't know. That's interesting. well, we certainly can't get away without talking about Supreme Audio.
Mm-hmm.
So, how did we get into that? And, tell us a little bit about where you've been going with that and what your plans are for the future for that.
Sure. We have maybe a classic hobby into a business story here. What we did is not that unusual. Very specifically, in 1982, our children had become teenagers and they were beginning to move on. Peggy was ready to go back to work. She had a master's degree in psychiatric social work, but did not want to return to the profession. So I said, well, why don't we turn our hobby into a business, and why don't we start a caller supply company? I needed a wireless microphone. I figured if I bought 4, sold 3, kept 1, might work out. Well, and that was really the beginning. Our first purchase was Edcore microphones. I remember it well. The ones with the $12 batteries. Anybody who's owned an Edcore knows the problem with expensive batteries. So we actually started with Edcore microphones, and then I went to a case manufacturer and designed the cases. I literally walked up with a box full of records, 45 RPM records, laid them out. I had my microphones with me, and I said, I need a case that will contain all of these records. And we designed that case. That was in 1982, and to this day we are still selling the same case and have never had to do a warranty replacement. What we designed then has turned out to be a good little product. And Peggy was really doing that full-time, and then my career, I was a division head in charge of the retail branches in Lower Manhattan for Chemical Bank. It was career-wise clearly time for me to bail out. My career had at best plateaued, so I got out, and I really went full-time with Peggy in 1985. So I've been full-time in the business since then. Once again, we started off as a pure caller and cure supply house. It was Caller's Corner, Cure's Corner was how we started. Then that was in 82, we started that way. In 83, I guess it was, Gene Vineyard, Bob Vineyard, who was the owner of Supreme Audio, passed away very suddenly, and we had been selling the speakers. The short and the long of it is we ended up purchasing Supreme Audio and had it driven up by truck to our house in New Jersey. And then in 1987, I bought Hanhurst's Tape and Record Service from Don and Loretta Hanhurst, mm-hmm. Then of Venice, Florida. They've since moved. And so that by 1987, we had become the largest supplier in the square dance industry. Also during that time, we had expanded into the tap jazz ballet community because we took the variable speed tape decks and turntables that they were being used in dance also. So we expanded into that, and very shortly thereafter we went into the fitness market, again because of variable speed CD and tape decks. And that evolved over time, and now the square dancing is exactly one-third of our business, and the tap jazz ballet and primarily fitness is two-thirds. On the fitness and tap jazz ballet, we service, you know, Susie's School of Dance. We service university dance departments. On the fitness side, we service Gold's Gym, World Gym, university fitness facilities, and we sell to most of the United States military fitness facilities around the world. We have a lot of shipboard sound. We have a lot of shipboard sound systems, and we only do the wireless microphones and the systems for the fitness facilities specifically.
No, this I didn't know. That's very interesting. I know you told me the last time I saw you at your home that you were doing considerable business with government agencies. I didn't realize what it entailed.
Yeah, it's actually our most, as a single segment, it's actually our most important segment other than square dancing.
Yeah.
It's number two behind square dancing.
Right. So, but you're not actively calling anymore.
No, when I moved, I stopped actively calling I moved in May of 93. We moved up to New Hampshire where you had seen us. I stopped calling probably at the end of that first year. I had a few dances up there that I had booked even before I moved, and then realized that with the local club situation, the local club had a caller and a regular club program going, I certainly was not going to start anything to compete with them. And since I didn't have a home teaching program, I really wasn't. I wasn't a traveling caller to begin with. I never was, and certainly did not want to become one.
Yeah.
And I really felt that without a home teaching program, it was not something I could sustain on a
realistic
basis. So I'm an active member of the club. I probably should be dancing more, but you know, with the pressures of family and business, like everybody else, we probably don't dance enough. But we've been very supportive of the club in a number of ways. I'm also a member of the Tri-State Callers Association, which is basically New Hampshire, Manchester, New Hampshire-based.
Yeah.
And it's got a wonderful, wonderful community of callers up there. They're pretty active in that also.
Yeah. But you are, I think you still do some one-night stands.
No, I actually stopped completely.
Well,
when I stopped, I really did hang up my mic. So basically, I haven't been calling actively now for 9 years.
Okay.
They really went hand in hand. I felt that the one-night stands were a wonderful way to introduce people to square dancing. I could never give you a statistic as to how many people came out of those one-night stands into the club activity as we know it, but it was always fun to do, and I really, you know, if I would ever start again, I would actually probably do exclusively one-night stands and fun nights.
That makes sense, the way the activity is going.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any views on, I should say before I pose the question, in my earlier interviews, I've always asked, where do you think square dancing has been, and where is it now, and where do you think it's going?
Well, to quote my dear friend Jim Mayo, and actually Dr. Robert Putnam, who wrote the book Bowling Alone, one really has to be somewhat philosophical as to where the curve for all of these kinds of activity is going. And I think realistically, we can't, we don't have the strength or financial strength to do something that is totally contrary to the curve, if you will, the activity level curve of where society is going. And I think we have to be pragmatic about doing that. The trend, as we've now seen it in Caller Lab, and the current thought is, I think, finally the right direction. And that is really to simplify it. I've been a proponent of this for many years now. I felt with the list structures the way they are, you really force and drive people to move on. It is human nature to go to, quote, higher levels. I know the word's not real popular, but that's in fact what it is. And so that human nature does drive the people up there. But I think that we really have to offer a more basic program. The old basic program, as it was, simply did not work. It really simply didn't work in that structure. But I think where we're going now at least has the beginnings of some modern common sense. One of the things that I've been very supportive of, both spiritually and frankly financially, is the whole marketing research effort that is going on at Caller Lab. Many years ago, I came up with the slogan, Excellence Through Education, which was actually adopted by Caller Lab at one of their conventions. It actually got a free year's dues out of that one. They used a slightly different version of it, but I've always felt that good square dance calling really needs two fundamental things. Good calling starts with a good heart. I think you have to be a person with really good feelings and good feelings towards fellow man, and good education, because I really feel that the education is the cornerstone of this whole thing. And for that very reason, we also, since I am quite prone to make public pronouncements of how I feel about things, I also backed it up with money, and we have been giving scholarships to college schools for 12 or 13 years now. I think we've given about 58, 59 of them so far. Peggy and I pay that, obviously, out of our own pocket. And these are partial scholarships, typically to three or four people each year, awarded in May. And we really have decided that if we believe strongly enough in that, then we have to help pay some of the cost of it. And once again, these are partial scholarships. There are certainly other scholarships available, fortunately, through Caller Lab and many other local callers associations. And the other thing I do is when I do seminar, I do a fair number of seminars every year at callers associations, and I do at least three or four a year. I have never accepted a fee for that, although they would normally pay me. I've always said to them, take $100 or $200, whatever you would have paid me, put it into your scholarship fund, and award an extra scholarship this year, because that's where I'd rather than see the money coming into my pocket, I'd frankly at this point rather see it going to education.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's very interesting. What's your opinion of modern-day caller schools? Maybe I should tell you a little bit of my opinion. There's so much so much emphasis on choreography that we're getting away from teaching people how to dance. I mean, we have gotten away from it. And, you have any thoughts along that line?
Yeah, I actually do. If I can just jump back to my mainstream class, because I think about my whole approach to teaching, and then I'll try and relate that to the college schools. My approach always was teaching people to dance and having fun, and I taught, not huge amounts, but I taught a good chunk of history and heritage in my class. I taught styling in my class. I taught an occasional content in the class. I'm not suggesting that it was a major component, but it was in there, sometimes to the protest of the club. As a matter of fact, they protested so loudly one year, I actually modified my contract for the following years with the specific clause in there that I and I alone have the authority to include or exclude anything into the program, but I would teach the call of that program, and I always did adhere to that. My greatest experience is, first of all, the school that I went to. I went to the Cal Golden School that I mentioned before, and then in 1986, I went to the Bill Peters, John Calton Fowler, Jim Mayo School. Mm-hmm. And if I can just digress and just tell a short story there, because it tells you how strongly I feel about education. In 1985, there was a reconstruction project to refurbish the Statue of Liberty. Mm-hmm. And as we all know, there were tens of millions of dollars raised around the country. As a matter of fact, I and our Callers Association down there had a big dance out at Liberty State Park, and we had 1,000 dancers. Once again, purely raising money, and I actually sounded the whole thing for free, and I had a lot of fun, help with a friend from Bill Anderson. And so we raised money for that. And then for the actual rededication ceremony, on that day, there was a three-hour ABC television broadcast on the air, and the long and the short of it is I was selected to do the broadcast, and I was in front of 80 million people, Bill Hyman, yeah. Liberty Square Dance Choir, and so
there
forth.
You go.
The reason why I tell the story is that being at that dance caused me to be a day late for my callers college. So I went from, obviously with a canned program, but from a national television appearance,
yeah,
representing square dancing to 80 million people with 220 of my square dance friends down on the floor and a couple of them up on the stage with me, 50-yard line at Giant Stadium. I went from that to being a day late, and I tried to sneak into the callers' college, coming in the side door, and that was very unsuccessful because unfortunately that year they put the whole arrangement so that the side door was right at the front of where the three instructors were sitting, and I said to Peggy, let's try and sneak in quietly, because in fact we were late. And needless to say, as I walked in, I thought we had made it. I got halfway to the back chair where I was, and then of course I got a standing ovation.
Yeah,
not of course, but I got a standing ovation.
There
of course
go.
Stood there crying. My point is telling it is that I went from the national appearance to go to a callers college to learn more about calling.
Yeah.
At a point prior to that, I had actually hired Bill Peters is a one-on-one coach, and he worked with me all day. We spent, I don't know, 6 hours working. I then took him to my class that evening. I called the worst square dance of my life. It was dreadful. The class took 2.5 hours. The critique took 3 hours.
Yeah.
So it was dreadful. Coming back to the key point of Corliss Colleges, the one college with which I am most familiar is what was the Johnston Brundage School in Massachusetts, which is now, as you well know, run by Randy Page and Mike Jacobs.
Right.
And I've been presenting at that school for 5 years now, 5 or 6 years now. I do, I've done a presentation on business, but I generally do digital music and equipment and use of equipment and all that. Based on the curriculum at that school, and I believe this is true back to its earlier days, that school always taught a much wider curriculum than just the pure choreographic things. It's clear that choreography dominates all of the college schools, but they do include a fair amount of other things in there, which it always pleased me. The other thing that they have, which I know has been done over the years, is they have a lot of new callers coming through each year.
Mm-hmm.
So they have their core staff, and then they have 1, 2, or 3 callers, if you will, joining them for just a year. And I've always found that attractive because it has the steadiness of the people who are really running the school with the freshness of other callers coming through, and I think that it has brought in input from other areas, not just choreographic input, but other activities and what's going on, different recruiting methodology and all that. So I think my overall feeling is
the schools, I think, or some, the school with which I am familiar, is doing a better job probably than some of the other schools. But we also, in fact, promote schools through our newsletter to our subscribers, our tape service subscribers. We included promotions for about six schools this year, and we also own dosado.com, mm-hmm. and because of that, we have the schools listed on there. We are the primer. We're really the only page in the world that has all of the schools with actual correct contact information and dates. Mm. It's all on one page, and there's a link right from the very front page. So if people are looking for caller schools, it's right there, and at the bottom, it says scholarship information. It's got the Caller Lab website and their scholarship page, and it's, of course, got our website with the scholarship page. Mm.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the web page, because that's certainly a very ambitious and very comprehensive endeavor. I'm constantly amazed every time I click onto it. I see something new, and I'm sure I haven't been through the whole thing yet, but it's quite a very ambitious endeavor and a tremendous contribution to the activity, obviously.
Thank you.
And, have you any thoughts about the so-called CDP program, the community dance program per se? I'm talking about this is a very limited program. What, I think 25 basics mm-hmm. they propose and so forth. Do you see any future for that type of program?
Well, as I understand it, what was the community dance program seems to have been modified. There's a CCP now, which is the Committee for Community Dance and all that, and that. I think one of the, and I don't want to say it's a problem, the inclusion of a very heavy contra, you know, let me put it this way, a very heavy inclusion of dances other than what we call modern Western square dancing, I think actually, and this is just one man's opinion, might have diffused the possibility of that being successful in our community, only because of the population in our community, the caller population in our community. There are probably relatively few people who have the interest, perhaps even also the skill, to professionally offer that diverse a program.
True.
In a real solid manner. You know, there are people, you know, the Bob Howells and the Jerry Heltz, and, you know, we all know the names of those people. Cal Campbell, obviously, has written a lot of the literature on it. But that is a very limited, I think, a limited teaching population, and I think even on the marketing side, I think that has some issues to it. I believe we're headed, if I understand it correctly, is that it would be basically a pure square dance program. That doesn't mean without any contest, but just not as high a content as I believe it had been in the past, and to get people doing more fun night type squares. In other words, without this long, long teaching obligation, and without the long term commitment to, you know, that if you don't go 1 week, you're going to be four moves behind and you'll never be able to get back into dancing. That is that has been very interesting. Along with that, if I could comment on the multi-cycle theory, because I'm a big proponent. I've never done it personally because I haven't been teaching during this period. But I attended at this last Caller Lab convention the multi-cycle session. Very good. There were 80 people in the room. It was a terrific session. And I have a lot of promotion of that on the website, too. There have been articles written by Nasser Shukair and Mike Seastrom and a couple of others. Wherever this program has been seriously pursued, success has happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know of no serious efforts at multi-cycle where it's failed. I know a lot of failures, including in New Hampshire, where they started it, tried it, maybe for one session. You know, they tried the January session, three people showed up, and they quit. And Chris Pinkham is the exception up in New Hampshire. He has a session. He's virtually looking for a larger hall now.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an incredible success story. And I think that this kind of, I'll call it 10-week cycle, and the key to the program is was very clearly emphasized in this past session at Caller Lab last week, was tailor it to fit your needs. It doesn't have to be 10 weeks, and it's not an absolutely firm list where you can only go from 1 to 23 or 28 or 30 moves on the list, but rather to really tailor to the needs of your area. If you're an agricultural area, if you're an urban area, suburban area, there are obviously different calendar issues, not to mention weather issues. availability of air-conditioned halls, heated halls, and so forth. But those areas that have done it are being successful, and it's pretty clear coming out of those groups, not all of those people are going to go on to what we now know is the club activity. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a terrific idea. Several of the people in that multi-cycle room said, what's happening is they're having like a phase one, phase two, phase three, in this case 10-week phases. The people are staying in there and just continue to do that. The phase one, maybe they'll stay phase one twice and then they'll go to phase two, and then they'll move on to phase three, but they continue on or stay back, you know, voluntarily put themselves back or recycle back. And it seems like they're having more success than any other of the starting programs at this point. So that is where I would see the greatest probability for, if you will, propagating the activity that we like. Once again, the modern Western segment of it, rather than the full traditional panoply. I came out of the traditional side for the years from 1979 to probably 89 or 90. My wife and I and our three children went to Pine Woods Camp, to the Country Dance and Song Society family weekends, and we danced traditional dances, contras and squares, for 8 or 9 or 10 years with our children every summer for a week. So I really probably have more time on that dance floor, and back in history, back in the 40s and 50s, I probably have more time in the traditional roots. So I have great respect and love for the traditional roots, but I'm really pretty well ensconced in the in the modern Western side of the world.
That's interesting. I was on staff at Pinewood for a few years, way back, and it's a tremendous program, of course, all live music, and that's, you see any future for live music?
I really don't. The only place, even right now, that I see live music is really in the pure traditional dance community. They are opposed to recorded music, and I fully understand them. I mean, you know, quite frankly, if you can afford a live quality dance band, that's wonderful, and I am the largest vendor of recorded music, but I would be the first one to say, if you can afford a dance band, absolutely hire them. Hands down, not a thing. I do remember, and it's almost romantic and emotional. I remember, if you know the C-sharp hall, it's the largest dance hall up at Pine Woods, the one it's a raised floor, it's up on stilts, it's maybe 6 or 8 feet off the ground, it is probably maybe 120 feet long by maybe 60, 80 feet deep. The stage is on the long side, so that there's great projection, and it's really like a folded horn speaker, the way they've structured it, so that the sound comes out of the band shell and literally covers the dance floor.
Right.
And as you know, that's a very sandy area, and despite their best efforts to keep sand off the dance floor, there's always some sand on it. You change your shoes coming out of the dance floor, but still sand gets on it. And when I would come to the dance a little bit late and they were already dancing, the most wonderful thing is, as you're far away, you can just sort of hear the music wafting through the woods. As you get closer, obviously the music gets louder, but the most interesting thing is, we always talk about the backbeat, the shuffle and the backbeat, when we're talking about music, boom, chuck-a-boom, chuck-a-boom. Well, when you come into that dance hall, the floor acts as a percussive instrument,
right,
so that you have 100 to 200 people dancing only to the beat of the music. I mean, nobody is offbeat, because phrasing is the key to that kind of dancing, as we all know, and it's one of the many reasons that we all love it. And you have this, so when you hear these dancing slippers are dancing through, and as they pull back on the floor, the sand is a little bit gritty, and it's almost like a percussive instrument. And it really is wonderful, because it adds to, it puts sort of a little bit of a snare drum effect, if you will, on the band. And the bands up there are really wild sometimes, right down to trombones and clarinets and everything else. They have some wonderful things. Piano was often one of the driving instruments in bands, which I happen to like. Piano was a dance band. I happen to casually know Bob McQuillan. I've danced Bob up in New England a couple of times. And when you have that piano, or Peter Barnes, the pianist, was a friend of Bob Dousmer, who was a close friend of ours, and when you hear that kind of piano driving the music, because it really is a bass and a melody instrument,
right.
And that is just wonderful, gotta dance music. And that was actually one of my couple of fondest memories, is just coming to that dance hall a little bit late, you could hear that music coming out with a percussive effect.
Well, Pappy Shaw was a big advocate of getting people to dance with the music, and that's the way he taught it. And mm-hmm. he'd start people dancing and lift the needle, and just all you'd hear was the shushing.
Yeah.
And I carried on that tradition when I started teaching classes back in Connecticut. And, but today you don't, nobody has the time to teach it. Square dancing that way.
Uh-huh.
And we were very repetitive. I remember we used to, when we taught, the night we taught Ladies' Chain, we did it as a visiting couple.
Uh-huh.
And Ladies' Chain, Ladies' Chain, go to the next, Ladies' Chain, Ladies' Chain, go to the next, Ladies' Chain, Ladies' Chain, period. And today's dancers would never, could never fathom trying to get through a figure that way. But they knew how the ladies changed when they got through.
You brought up an interesting comment, because implied in there is that you were changing partners, if you will.
Yeah.
And it's one of the other differences between how we have embraced modern Western square dancing today and what the traditional standard is, at least today in traditional dancing. I don't know if it was always that way, but I suspect it was. You change partners every set of music, every tip. Except the first and the last, you dance with the one you brung.
Mm.
And that's the way I always danced at dance camp. Certainly that was the standard at Pinewoods. You were almost frowned upon if you hung on to your sweetheart all night. If you were very useful, you were supposed to share on the dance floor. But of course, the closing waltz, Bob McCrohan waltz, with Randy Miller on a wonderful mellow violin and fiddle, was really quite an emotional experience. You danced the first and last with the one you brung. And in between that, you change partners every tip. And that was the standard that was accepted. In modern Western dancing, it is, with rare exception, I'm sure there's some clubs that do it, it is rarely, rarely accepted. So one night when I was calling in Jersey, I spoke to the president of the club. I said, I'd like to do some partner changing. So he said, no problem at all. And this was a very clicky club. This was like Click City. And I just called four ladies, chain three quarters, heads pass through and find another square.
Mm-hmm.
And half the floor just turned and looked up at me, and I danced the tip that way, and I almost got my head taken off the inner tip. There was one guy, he was just hopping mad, and I saw, boy, he was coming at me. I could see flames just shooting out his nostrils, and I was talking to a woman, and the conversation with the woman had functionally ended. I continued the conversation. I asked her more questions. I made some other comments, and I intentionally made the guy who had flames coming out his nose wait. And he eventually just turned around and walked away. Because I actually, quite candidly, I did not want to hear what he had to say. I knew what he had to say. The speed with which he approached me communicated all. And that club never hired me back.
Yeah.
That club never hired me back.
Well, it's an indication of the activity, of course. And perhaps the general population.
Society,
yeah.
Yeah.
But, of course, I suppose part of the reason is most of the people that are square dancing in modern Western today are older people, and they've been with their wives for 30 years. And to keep changing partners is a young people's thing. Because, you know, the contra dancers, at least in Albuquerque, the contra dancers there tend to be younger.
Oh, yeah, much younger.
And well, that's very interesting. You've certainly had an interesting square dancing life, and I'm sure you plan to continue for many, many years, and wish you plenty of success with your Supreme Audio and your web page and everything.
Thank you very much.
It's been a tremendous contribution to the activity, there's no doubt about it. Anything you'd like to add?
Just as anybody else who is in this circle, Peggy and I have a really deep love for square dancing. I left a somewhat successful career. I don't want to make it sound bigger than it was, because it was the early 80s and careers had a lot of problems then. But we really did leave a high-paying job to do this. I've learned to live with less money. That's not been a problem for us, and it's even less now that dancing is down. And due to the recession now, of course, our other business is, of course, down quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But we continue to do the things that are important to us. Square dancing is certainly not our only other volunteer activity. We are very involved in other boards of directors. Peggy is on the board of the New Hampshire Dance Institute and spends a lot of time, and we are also financially supportive there. That's the Jacques d'Amboise dance program for kids who might not be exposed to dance otherwise. We're very involved in that. And I actually just joined the Colonial Theater's Board of Directors, mm-hmm. which is the local restored antique movie theater, typical 1920s movie theater, typical to many, many old New England and other cities' cores. And they're now 9 years old. They are, in fact, this year we had our first profitable year, so we're very involved in their programs, trying to help them. We've also done some fundraising for the Keene Chamber Orchestra by having house concerts. So Peggy and I are not only involved in square dancing, but we're involved in other areas of the community. And I just did a website for the town of Marlborough, and I'm their webmaster. We do a lot of volunteer things, a lot of fun things. I'm on the Conservation Commission. So we have about 9 different activities going, and it keeps us happy and busy.
You turned into an old New Englander.
Yeah, I am. I'm very much, as a matter of because of the property we bought, we have 165 acres of woodlands. We are, in fact, a certified American tree farm.
There.
And we do logging about every 3 to 5 years. We do it there, in fact.